Commence.
House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Colleagues, it is good to see you after a little bit of a break. We're going to get going on our... Don't laugh so much on that.
Still wait for my break.
That's right. We're going to open a public hearing on both House Bill 4107 and House Joint Memorial 201. Representative Smith Warner, would you care to kick us off on HJM 201, please?
Shall I go down to that? That
would be great, I think. And while she's walking down, Rick, could you give us a short description, please?
Thank you, Chair. Just briefly, this is a House Joint Memorial that urges Congress to enhance safety standards for new and existing rail cars used to transport crude and other flammable liquids. There is a Dash 1 amendment attached, which adds language urging the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration to strengthen standards for new tank cars, require existing cars used for transporting hazardous materials to be properly retrofitted with advanced technology, and if not upgraded, then phased out of service. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Bailey and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, State Representative from House District 45, which covers portions of Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Joint Memorial 201. This bill asks Congress to strengthen safety standards for new and existing tank cars used to transport crude oil by rail. You've probably seen a lot of the recent media coverage of accidents involving freight trains that were carrying crude oil, including the horrific event last July where a train derailed outside a small town in the province of Quebec, killing 47 people and destroying 30 buildings. As guardians of our state's public safety, we cannot stand idly by and wait for such a loss of life and community here in Oregon. As the domestic oil industry has outpaced pipeline development in the United States, oil companies increasingly rely on freight rail lines to move their product to market. Historically, railroads are a safe method of ground freight transportation. However, many cars used to transport crude oil are older and do not have to meet the same safety standards as cars used to transport other hazardous materials. Of the roughly 92,000 tank cars today used to move flammable liquids, including crude and ethanol, only about 14,000, only 15%, are built to the latest industry safety standards. In the past year, trains carrying crude oil have derailed in Alabama, North Dakota, and Mississippi, spilling over 1 million gallons of oil in the United States. As a matter of fact, in the year 2013, there was more oil spilled in derailments than in the last 37 years combined. The need for safety upgrades, including increased puncture resistance to decrease the risk of deadly explosions and fires should a derailment occur, is both well documented and widely agreed upon. Today I offer a Dash 1 amendment, which not only strengthens the memorial by adding specificity, it brings additional key stakeholders to the table, including Oregon-based railcar companies. We expect no opposition to the bill. I'll close with this. In 2011, a log train derailed outside Scappoose. It hit a tanker filled with ethanol, starting a fire that burned so hot, firefighters were forced to pull back half a mile. Those firefighters were quoted in the Oregonian saying they got lucky because the accident didn't happen near homes or near drinking water. The previous year, about 7.7 million barrels of North Dakota crude traveled along those same rails on similar tank cars, right through a number of small communities along Highway 30. If we fail to take action, next time we may not be so lucky. I thank you again for the opportunity to bring this issue before you, and I urge your support for House Joint Memorial 201 and the Dash 1 Amendment. Let's send a strong message to Congress that now is the time to act for the health and safety of our families and communities. And I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Before we go to questions, Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. Very pleased to be here in support of HJM 201 with the Dash 1 amendments. I think they do strengthen it and add clarity on some particular parts. This is why we have short sessions. We have these types of issues that are timely, where we as a legislature should weigh in with our federal elected folks in D.C. and say, you need to act on this. And some people say, well, you know, joint memorials don't do anything. There is a growing chorus every day on the safety issues around tank cars that are carrying more and more crude oil, particularly from North Dakota, which is more flammable. In Olish, I think there's an attachment there of a map showing Oregon's railroads and where those railroads are and all the various communities they go through. The reason this is particularly important to me is in North Portland, we have a train track that runs from state of Washington, from the Port of Vancouver, cross through the St. John's neighborhood in what we call the Cut, which is a recessed area that cuts through the peninsula of that is my district, and then goes over across another river over to that goes up to Scappoose. If one of those trains with those tank cars, which are now currently going through my community, and if they're in tank cars that don't meet the higher safety standards that we're asking for in this memorial, and one of those tips over and blows up in my district, that's a catastrophic loss of life. Quebec will be a speck compared to what, you know, what happened in Quebec. If that happened in North Portland, it would be devastating for Portland and for my district and for Oregonians. This memorial is important. I think there's a lot of action happening at the national level right now on this issue, and this just adds our voice as a legislature saying we need to have those safer tank cars as soon as we possibly can. And I do think the railroads here in Oregon are trying to help. When I met with many of their representatives, they're trying to go slower on the tracks. They're trying to make sure the tracks are clear. They can do some things locally, but if those tank cars are so old and so unsafe and they have more highly flammable crude oil in them, we're going to have a problem. Things, accidents do happen. So I urge you to support this joint memorial. The amount of crude that's been spilling and the increased number of trains, this is an urgent issue now, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. And I would simply note, colleagues, I think to the Speaker's point, you do have some testimony here, and I've certainly received communication from at least a couple of railroads in support of the memorial. Are there questions? Representative Whitsitt.
I was just wondering, have they determined what the causes of the accidents were that have happened? I mean, I've read too, and I didn't know if the National Transportation Safety Board had determined the causes of those accidents in the United States. I don't know if anyone knows.
I'm not sure the U.S. ones. I've read some reports of the Quebec accident that was an unattended train that had basically gotten away and then derailed and crashed. But I do not know specifics about the specific causes of each of the U.S. ones.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, the one in, was it recently, a small one in remote Wyoming or somewhere, I think it was just a regular derailment but once one car goes, mm-hmm. they all go up.
I have a follow-up. Ball, please. Do we know, or will somebody testify, can we use older cars that are retrofitted, the tank cars, or do they have to be new cars, and what kind of costs we might be looking at?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, my understanding is that they indeed can, that right now there are three types of cars that are qualified, and what we're trying to do is phase out, get official word to phase out the oldest type, which is indeed the most likely to puncture when it derails, and to either replace it with the two newer versions or retrofit. I believe that retrofitting is an option.
And I would note that we have no other sign-ups on this memorial, so if you got questions, ask them.
Thank you.
Representative Bruton.
Just a comment. I mean, it seems like an excellent thing to do, of course. But would some of the rail cars possibly be built by local Oregon companies?
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon, I believe there is a representative from a local rail car company in the room that might be able to answer that.
Great. Yeah. Would you care to come up?
Another question here before. It's excellent. We're better roads.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I apologize. I was outside trying to draft another amendment for a different bill and didn't get signed up. For the record, Sean Jillians with Tonkin Torp here representing the Greenbrier Companies, obviously Oregon-based manufacturer of rail cars. We are in support of the Dash 1 amendments. And to some of the questions that were raised, Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, Greenbrier has developed a retrofit for existing cars. The initial cost estimates are between $15,000 and $18,000. $1,000 per car to retrofit it, and Greenbrier stands ready and willing to go forward on those retrofits. They are also developing a heavier tank car as well in anticipation, not only of existing standards, but future standards coming down. They anticipate that will be ready within the next 18 months. So we very much support and appreciate the work of the Speaker and Representative Smith-Warner in moving this forward and being willing to work on amendments to kind of channel Congress in the right direction. I think the original proposal was just tell Congress to do something. There's an existing process within the USDOT and their pipeline administration that's ongoing. We'd like to see that move forward quicker, and so I think that this memorial achieves that. With that, I'd be happy, Mr. Chair, to answer any additional questions.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean, do I hear you say then that there are, in fact, let's say, industry-wide acceptable standards for a rail car that would be involved in transmitting petroleum products? So it's not just a matter of adding more stuff, but you would know exactly what to add, or Burt Greenbrier, whoever, would know what to add in order to reach that level of good housekeeping seal of approval, if you will.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Johnson, yes, there's okay. Currently standards. What this memorial is encouraging is strengthening the standards at the federal level so that everyone knows exactly what they're looking at. Obviously, Greenbrier is ready to move forward on retrofits without that standard, but if it was clear exactly what was expected, that's even better from their perspective.
Right. And just a quick follow-up. So these are federal standards that exist, but states have to comply with that. So we don't have rail cars being made in Alabama that are different from rail cars being made in Oregon. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Johnson, yes. The federal railroads and are governed at the federal level, obviously.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jillian, something must have changed. The standards that have been in place have worked for more or less for a long time. So what's changed to require this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I think there's just an awareness of the technology and what we're capable of as far as retrofits of existing cars, and also looking at the gradual phase out of those older cars that have been in service for a long period of time.
Paul, I had assumed, possibly incorrectly, that it was the fact that trains are being used as pipelines now to move oil out of the Bakken area, and that there's a lot more oil on the rail than there used to be, and that's why we're looking at the possibility of increased chance of an accident. Would that have anything to do with it? Mm-hmm. Or is there, I mean, we like you just said, we have standards in place, but apparently those aren't as high. And I also have heard, as the speaker alluded to, that some of the fuel that's being produced has a much higher flash point, or a much burns a lot hotter, whatever the right term is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, appreciate the question. So crude oil tank cars do not meet the same standards as the rail cars right now that carry other hazardous and flammable materials. And I'm not a scientist on this issue, but my guess is you have more trains, and you do have a type of crude that is more flammable. So those old standards, so previous crude, less cars, not as much of an issue, probably not as flammable. We have higher standards for other types of more hazardous materials, so we need to make sure that those standards match what is, one could argue, a more flammable crude that is coming through on more cars on a regular basis. If that helps.
That helps. Thank you.
I wonder, the sponsors, I guess. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benz, I think, hits on the idea of the topic here. Yes, there is more crude on rails than there has been because there's more production occurring, but there are other ways to transport that crude, i.e. in pipelines. Would you consider an amendment also asking Congress to expedite the construction of certain pipelines that have been in them as a means of keeping those trains out of Portland and metro areas so that they could get be exported in a much more safe fashion to the markets that are waiting for that product?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Johnson, I'm not aware of pipelines being proposed for the Pacific Northwest at this point. I mean, the issue is that we don't have the pipeline capacity to carry additional crude to the refineries in the Northwest, so they are putting things on the rails. And so I think that's a separate conversation, but in the meantime, they're putting them on the cars. That's the only way to get them here. So,
thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, and we appreciate you bringing this forward. And, Madam Speaker, if you would care to stay at the podium, we'll move on to our next bill. And, colleagues, we're also currently under public hearing for House Bill 4107. Rick, would you care to give us a quick description?
Briefly, Chair, thank you. This 4107 does extend the alternative fuel vehicle revolving fund to certain private entities that operate a fleet of motor vehicles. You do have the Dash 1 amendments that allows the Department of Energy to require private entities, public bodies, or tribes that apply for loan from the fund to pay 0.1% of the loan amount. This stipulates that these same entities applying for loan may be required to pay the department for costs incurred with the application if it exceeds the application fee, and DOT has other determinants on that. Extends to the biennium July 1st, 2015, a requirement that limits on total amounts of potential tax credit for all transportation projects be reduced by the total amount of potential tax credits auctioned under the Oregon law. And then it does extend this applicable tax law by 2 years from 2015 to 2017.
And I think, Madam Speaker, while you kick us off, Ms. Bach, maybe it makes sense to have you come up to the podium as well, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland State Representative and Speaker of the House. It's fun to be in energy and environment. I'm glad to be here today. Thank you for hearing another bill. This was drafted at my request because there's a district reason here, but I think it's a bill that helps other parts of the Portland area and other parts of the state, not just my district. So House Bill 4107 with the Dash 1, so I do draw your attention to Dash 1. It's a bill to help with air quality by building on an existing program. So in 2013, last year, we passed Senate Bill 583, and I want to thank Senator Starr as being one of the primary champions of that bill, to set up a fund where we could let public entities have access to a revolving loan fund to upgrade their fleets to cleaner burning engines. That fund is just now coming into activity, so we don't really have some numbers there, but everyone agreed that at the time that it would be good to capitalize a fund that could be a revolving loan fund that could allow public entities to convert their fleets for a whole lot of reasons. Good for the economy, good for the air, good just for creating jobs, just all around a good idea to do. And you'll note that we approved at the same time the ability for the Department of Energy to sell credits to finance that fund. So that's already been approved. But one of the things we want to make sure by doing this, the reason it came about is I represent many industrial areas in the Portland area, north and northeast Portland. We have, for example, a UPS site on my in my district on Swan Island. It's a distribution point. And so I see these trucks coming up off of Swan Island every day in North Portland. And so I started to talk to the UPS folks. I'm like, how do we get you to have cleaner engines? And they said, well, you know, when other states actually require us to have cleaner engines, we just send you all our older ones, right? We send you our diesel trucks because, you know, we can do gas in other places because we're required. And so we had this long conversation about their engines and what, you know, what kind of tools could we provide within our limited resources to help you convert your fleet. So hence we ended up with the revolving loan fund, extending it to certain private entities in areas that are known to have high pollution, you know, significant air quality problems. So in this case, connecting it to the state program, this is the Portland metro area and the Medford area. There are other areas of the state that have also some air quality problems, but that's where you'd see the most activity according to this bill. We also wanted to narrow it to those, by narrowing it geographically, that helped not overtap the fund, so we wouldn't use up all the dollars for the public entities who want to use it, because this would allow certain private entities. Also narrowed it by saying it would be restricted to companies. It wouldn't be available for independent contractors. We wanted to stick to companies who were focusing on their own business-owned fleets, and that could be a pretty small company or a very large company, but that's why you see the independent contractor piece in there. We just wanted to narrow it. We don't know how much utilization will be, but we want to make sure we're moving it forward, but not, you know, prohibiting some of the public entities from using it, which was the bill that was originally passed. So the Dash 1s do extend the timeline by which the department can sell the credits. They've been allowed to sell up to $3 million in credits to fund this revolving loan fund. They've only sold about $1 million. So that's why you see that extension there in the Dash 1. And also we would allow the department to charge a fee on the financing of, you know, in the loan administration. So that would help keep the program solvent and sustainable. So that's the bill. Online you'll see, I don't know if everyone's able to make it down for testimony. OEC has some Oregon Environmental Council has testimony in support. Teamsters Local number 162 also in support. There was an accident on I-5. I don't know if Bill has made it down. And then we also have some information from the Department of Energy and Metro. So we have the fiscal on it. I hope we can, you know, move it as soon as possible, if not today, on Thursday. But I encourage your support and look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. We currently, the only sign-up we have additionally is from the Department of Energy. So if you'd
care to listen. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Buckley. Excuse me. I'm the Division Administrator for the Energy Department's Energy Development Services Division. And I apologize. I was late, so I didn't sign up. Hence, Ms. Bach was here. I am here to voice the department's support for what we perceive as really good policy. With that, I do want to introduce Maureen Bach, the Energy Incentives Program Manager, to deliver the department's testimony.
And Madam Speaker, obviously, I know you are extremely busy. If you would care to stay through the testimony, you're welcome to. We'd love to be able to ask
questions. I believe I must depart, but thank you very much. I appreciate the time, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Bach,
Chair
please.
Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Maureen Bach. I'm the Energy Incentive Program Manager for the Department of Energy. So I have responsibility for overseeing some of the tax credit programs, and that is why I'm here, because some of the tax credits that are capped at $20 million per biennium for transportation were sold initially to fund this revolving loan program. And so that is the initial funding source for the revolving loan program that was set up last year and was made available to public bodies and the federally recognized tribes here in Oregon. So the money, like I said, came from the sale of these tax credits and allows borrowers to borrow money to pay for the incremental cost of either purchasing a vehicle that is an alternative fuel vehicle or to convert it, an existing gas or diesel vehicle to an alternative fuel vehicle. So I think last year when Senate Bill 583 was being considered, you heard from Polk County where they converted patrol cars to be dual fuel vehicles. So they had greater distance and they could run on gasoline or propane. So those would be the kinds of projects that would be funded in the public sector. The Dash One, as we said, allows, and as the speaker said, allows the department to charge a loan origination fee, and that would cover the cost of the of processing loans that may or may not go through. So it's a cost recovery mechanism for the department. And then the amendment also extends the period of time we have to have the Department of Revenue sell the credits to pay for this fund. So, like the speaker said, the auction was initially held in November, and the net proceeds that we have in the fund right now are about $954,000. With that, I'll entertain any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much money has been loaned under the program so far?
Chair Bailey, Representative Bentz, as of now, we have not lent any money. We just did rulemaking and finished that in December and opened the opportunity period for this loan program in January, and we'll close it in March. So we will know at the end of March what how many loans we have. Or what the appetite is for loans.
Hello, Mr. Chair. And the terms of the loan, we're, the concern, of course, is who are we competing with? It was one thing for us to make this available to publics, but now to privates. Who are we competing against, and are the terms of the loan competitive in the sense of if I went to the bank and asked, would I get the same terms, or can I get better terms if I come and ask the state?
Chair Bailey, Representative Bentz, great question. The fact that this fund is pre-funded with proceeds from an auction, we can offer flexibility in terms and rate. That the real answer to that is it's subjective to the borrower, what the risk profile is. The competition, which we try and manage the SELP program, so it doesn't is not in direct competition with a commercial bank. We try and offer a solution where the commercial banks either don't have a product or don't understand, and they need a little more education in underwriting these types of loans.
Well, so the obvious question is, if the bank isn't making the loan, there's usually a reason. It has to do generally with the risk. So is there a chart or something online that shows us the higher the risk, the higher the interest rate? Is that how the program has been put together? I'm obviously interested in making sure this is truly a revolving loan fund, as opposed to just a here's the money fund.
Chair Bailey, Representative Vince. There's not a chart online. Again, setting rates is somewhat of an art, depending on what the risk profile is. We do price risk into our rates. So you could have borrower A paying a 2% rate, borrower B with a higher risk profile paying 5%, 6%, or even a 7% rate. Again, those aren't real numbers. They're just estimations right now. It's priced according to the risk. Not every borrower is alike. I hope that answers your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence. I was known as Mr. Foreclosure in Eastern Oregon for about 20 years, and I worked for at least 30 banks, going out and collecting loans. So I'm familiar with how that works. Mm-hmm. I just want to know what you look at when you are going to establish an interest rate, because it can't be subjective. There's got to be guidelines, got to be rules. Are those in the rules that have now been written, and can we look at those rules and predict what the rate will be with appropriate understanding of the risk? Let me give an example. There's a large company in Oregon called Waste Management that I know is in the process of converting to natural gas. If Waste Management came in and asked for a loan, what would their rate be?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, members of the committee. So again, I've made a commitment to this body, this legislative body, with the management of the SELP program to mitigate risk, the exposure to risk over time from the past history of the program. This particular program and any loan that we underwrite today considers a number of factors. If Waste Management were to come to us, we look at the borrower's profile, and typically we refer to the five C's of credit. We look at the ability of the borrower to pay, what are their resources, what's the character of the borrower. Waste Management would get what would be a rate lower than the commercial market rate. One of the questions we'd ask is why us and not the commercial market? We do dig deep into what the risk is that particular borrower represents.
I never quite heard what the rate would be. So I know it must fluctuate with the market.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't really predict what the rate would be. Maybe you can give me a range, a low of X and a high of Y.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benson, members of the committee. I failed to look at what the rates were today, but I could tell you if a commercial bank is offering a similar type product at, let's again assume that rate is 5% or 5.99, what this program has the ability to do because of the pre-funding is offer a rate of based if it's a very high quality borrower, I would tell you it's probably anywhere from 2% to 4%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And why would it be lower than the commercial rate? If it's Waste Management, as we're using as the hypothetical.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, members of the committee, why a lower rate than the commercial offering? Part of the SELP's mission is to incentivize a change in behavior to help move the market along. Again, commercial banks tend not to want to underwrite in this field, and a lot of times it is their understanding of what the product or what the borrower is trying to accomplish.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I'd like to comment on how impressed I am that somebody known as Mr. Foreclosure got elected to office.
Didn't his name a long time ago.
And then I wanted to just see if you could go into a little bit more detail and help me understand how this some of the safeguards or how we're going to ensure that the money that we set aside in the initial Senate bill last session, that money for public entities who have been using this who we assume will be using this program, how we're going to make sure that there's still money for those public entities with this change.
Chair Bailey, Representative Vega Peterson, thank you for that question. We did put in our existing rules, safeguards that say how much we will allow any one borrower to have, and then we allowed ourselves to look at usage of the fund and give more to a certain entity, the concern being for public sector that certain large entities might take up all of the fund at one time. So we did put that in rules when we were working with our stakeholders. And because this would be adding new people, we would have to do additional rulemaking. So the public sector would still have the first opportunity to get into that fund before we loaned to any private sector entities.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just to follow up on that, I think part of the intent of the Senate Bill 583 was not just to help these public bodies to modernize their fleets, put more fuel-efficient vehicles on the roads, but also to help save their taxpayers some money because their overhead and costs of maintaining these vehicles would go down. So I guess I'm concerned that we could end up with a situation where some of these private entities could be new kids on the block and maybe ready to go and push out some of these public bodies and therefore deny, I think, the taxpayers of these communities and all of us those benefits from saving, you know, saving costs through more efficient management. So it seems to me that there would need to be some rulemaking attached to this somehow to ensure that the ratio or whatever doesn't cut into what the original purpose of the bill we passed last session was. Is that something that's in play, or are you just envisioning a process that would take care of that as you, with the passage of this bill?
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee, that's a good question, and we did actually consider that in that we would have to do rulemaking to set same standards or higher standards for public entities in these areas to come in based on where the fleet is based and those kinds of things. So our existing rules have pretty tight guidelines about how we would allocate and prioritize, and I think we would want to do a similar process involving the public, and certainly any legislators that are, you know, interested would be welcome to participate and look at that process so we're meeting the intent of the original bill.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, Representative Whitsitt.
I have a couple questions. So is it correct that the genesis of the change did not result from any private entity approaching you and asking for the change?
Representative Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, members of the committee, this is the speaker's bill. This was not our bill.
Okay. So you don't know then. She would be the one who would know that.
That's
okay.
Correct.
And then I was wondering if I missed it, what is the term of the typical loan that you would offer time-wise?
Representative Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, typically the incremental cost for these vehicles is $6,000 to $30,000, depending on, and it's the same for conversion, depending on the size of the vehicle, the fuel tank capacity, and those kinds of things. So the terms would probably be fairly short, but I'm sure that Mr. Buckley could probably address that in greater detail.
Okay, I'm looking for time, basically.
Representative Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, members of the committee. I believe the original bill, Senate Bill 583, capped the term in as regards time to 6 years. Again, I would remind, or kindly remind the committee, subjective to borrowers, we can be flexible. We can't go beyond 6 years. You could have a borrower go anywhere from 1 year up to 6 years.
Okay, and I just have one follow-up. Could you describe the typical cost difference in a new car using alternative fuels versus regular fuels? So what are we looking at if an entity of some sort says, I want to buy a car versus a regular gas versus alternative fuel? Can you say what the difference is in the cost per vehicle?
Representative Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, that is the incremental cost would be about $6,000 to $30,000, depending on, like I said, the size of the vehicle. So smaller cars typically are less. A medium-duty delivery vehicle might be up to $30,000, depending on the fuel capacity for that vehicle.
Thank you.
Okay, we appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much. Do we have a Bill Elzey here? Sir, would you care to join us for testimony in House Bill 4107, please?
Thank you very much. My name is Bill Elsey. And speaking in support of House Bill 4107 and opening up to the private entities, the certain private entities that the bill sponsors have presented to you. I have submitted written testimony to that effect. I'm hopeful that it got onto the information system in front of you. I do have copies of my letter for presentation to the committee, if you would desire at this time.
We have your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Basically, I'm here to support the opening up to the private entities for the alternative, the revolving alternative fuel vehicle revolving fund loan program. I see in my industry, I'm a business agent with Teamsters Local 162 in Portland, Oregon. And I have I deal with the employers. I'm seeing what the results of the recession has done. And during this recession, we have seen employers having to cut back on their capital improvements and maintaining their fleets. And so for about 7 years, they have not been updating their fleets. They are getting old. I'm now seeing the tide turn in the terms of employment with these employers that we deal with in the motor carrier, commercial motor vehicle industry. And I speak in support of opening up this revolving fund for those private entities. Let's see what the businesses of this state can do within the watershed, airsheds of the Medford and Portland area. Let's let them try to do the right thing. If you make it responsible for them, it'll pencil out, and we will see more alternative fuel commercial motor vehicles being able to be purchased by the private industries. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elsey. Appreciate your testimony.
Any questions?
Any questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who'd wish to testify on House Bill 4107? Seeing none, close the public hearing on House Bill 4107 and the public hearing on HJM 201, and committee will stand at ease.
instructions.
Committee will come back to order, and we're going to continue with our public hearings. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4041. Call up Dan Eisenbeiss, please. And we have Lisa Abwoff on the phone as well. Rick, will you give us a quick description, please?
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 4041 expands the Energy Improvement Program by authorizing local governments to facilitate private financing of energy improvements by property owners, authorizes local governments establishing program to impose requirements to ensure that costs of finance improvements do not exceed cumulative energy cost savings over life of improvement. That does modify definition of qualifying real property to exclude single-family residential programs. You did a -1 amendment that basically requires that local government not enter into a long agreement or facilitate a financial agreement unless the owner provided written notice to all mortgagees of the property that owner intended to enter into or financing agreement and receive written consent from mortgagees stating that loan or financing agreement does not constitute an event of default or give rise to any remedies under the terms of the mortgage loan agreement. Thank you, Chair.
Colleagues, we have House Bill 4041 and the -1 amendment, which we'll hear about. You'll recall this is the bill that we discussed and had a hearing on during the January legislative day. So, Mr. Eisenbeiss, thank you for joining us, and Ms. Abwoff, and whoever would like to start can start, and we'll get an update on where we're at with this bill.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Daniel Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of House Bill 4041, as well as the -1 amendment. First, want to acknowledge Chair Bailey's leadership on this topic. As the committee heard during January legislative days, state statute currently authorizes a local government to voluntarily establish a program to provide loans to property owners, again on a voluntary basis, for energy efficiency building renovations that are repaid via a property assessment. This model is known as property assessed clean energy or PACE financing. Current statute requires that loans be capitalized by either a state SELP loan or through sale of local government general revenue bonds. The bill before you would simply provide local governments the flexibility to partner with private sector lenders in making PACE financing available for industrial, commercial, or multifamily properties. The -1 amendment would clarify that a mortgage lender for a property must consent in order for a PACE loan to be provided to that property. House Bill 4041 will help property owners make cost-effective energy efficiency improvements by giving local governments the flexibility to leverage private capital through a financing model that is also convenient for property owners. We urge your support and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. I want to make sure I understand what you said correctly. The -1 amendment essentially means that if there is an existing lien holder on a property, that this is not a program that's going to come in on top of them without their consent. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. Ms. Abwoff, you have anything to add?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Bailey and committee members. For the record, I'm Lisa Abwoff. I'm a Central City Manager with the Portland Development Commission in Portland, Oregon. And as the chair mentioned, last month we came before you to share our technical findings that we compiled together with Multnomah County when we started looking at a PACE program, its administration and structure nationally. And we're here again today to speak in support of this legislation. The Portland Development Commission, as some of you may be aware, is the city's economic development and redevelopment agency, and we do support House Bill 4041 as well as the -1 amendment that are before you today. We continue to hear from our partners and peers, both locally and nationally, that an open market PACE framework that would be made possible by this House bill and the -1 amendment makes retrofits in the retrofit market more compelling to both investors and property owners. The bill would allow local governments in Oregon to voluntarily establish PACE programs that leverage this private sector participation. We're also confident that the changes proposed in House Bill 4041 align with the direction that PACE is moving in nationally. Before closing, I'd like to provide you with just one example of this public and private opportunity that we've encountered as we've looked at a PACE program in Multnomah County and in the Portland region. The Loy District property owners and business owners in Portland have recently completed an energy analysis of their own district and have mapped 15 actions they're proposing to take over the next 5 years. The majority of these tied to retrofitting their existing commercial building stock. Collectively, they've identified that these activities could result in approximately $16 million in energy investments alone and could generate operating savings to our local property owners of $800,000 annually. This savings also results in an initial return on investment of over 5% and an enhanced building value in the Portland market of $11 million. It's this kind of economic and real estate activity that PDC hopes to support through an open market-based PACE program, and we urge you to support House Bill 4041 and the Dash-1 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on House Bill 4041? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 4041. And we're going to move to a work session on HJM 201.
That's it. Chair Bailey, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 2514 of HJM 201.
Vice Chair Johnson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to HJM 201 dated 2-5-2014. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, amendment carries.
Chair Bailey, I move HJM 201 as amended to the floor to with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves HJM 201 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Spence?
Aye.
Representative Meininger?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Smith-Morton?
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Excuse me.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. HJM 201 is headed to the floor. Representative Smith-Warner, would you care to carry?
Yes, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, close the work session on HJM 201. Open a work session on House Bill 4041.
Chair Bailey, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 2-5-14 for House Bill 4041.
Vice Chair Johnson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 2-5-2014 to House Bill 4041. Any discussion? Any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, amendment carries.
Chair Bailey, I move House Bill 4041 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves House Bill 4041 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Pence?
Aye.
Representative Meininger?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Smith-Warner?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Weiner?
Excused.
Representative Bissett?
No.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries, and I will carry House Bill 4041. We'll close the work session on. No, actually, hold on a second. Representative Leininger, I don't think you've had a bill yet this session to carry on the floor.
I'm so new.
I think Representative Leininger should carry House Bill 4041.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. We'll give it to Representative Leininger, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 4041. I announce that we are going to carry over the work session on House Bill 4107 to Thursday. And I've given sufficient notice of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I believe that exhausts our agenda, does it not?
We have carryovers then for Thursday, or that's it?
That's it. So Thursday we have a public hearing, and we have the carried over work session, House Bill 4107, and with that, the committee is adjourned.
Thank you.
So what?